So as we begin the Dharma talks for this retreat, I would like to read this story. It was written by a prisoner in San Quentin. I don't know if it's true or not, but I'm sure it's true in some way. My night was like any other night. It was 8 p.m., time for close custody count. All prisons have institutional counts wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for a count is considered a serious violation. The officer came to our cell and called my bunkie's name, after which he gave him the last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. Half an hour passed, and a neighbor comes to my cell and said they were paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, "Why are you not in your cell for count? Why were you not in your cell for count?" And I told them, "I was in my cell for count, as I have been every day and night for 12 years, and I have numerous neighbors that can verify that." It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again, and I am like, whatever. 2 days go by, and I find out that the sergeant gave me a write-up for a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I truly am not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who will say the same. However, at the hearing, the cop that counted said he looked into the cell 2 times and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra duty. I said to myself, screw this. I am not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong, and these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. That is the last thing I wanted to do, but I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do those 40 hours of extra duty. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it, and regardless of the circumstances and the injustice of it, see if I could do what ultimately would be best for me. She said she would accept what I would decide, but if I could, please act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I have always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere, no matter what. So, not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could do. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I still felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra duty, I set off to shine up this hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the result of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up that fire hydrant, I had become bigger than the unfairness that led me to my assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison, kind of like a small lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out on how to steer and how to move through this place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. So I like the story. I thought of it today because I got a letter sent here to me from prisoner San Quentin, and I'll read that in a little bit for you. And so there was, it reminded me of this story, and then when I thought about how the theme of this retreat is has to do with the elements of concentration and how they support mindfulness, I remember the story of this man who gave himself wholeheartedly over, you could say in a concentrated way, to polishing a fire hydrant in the prison. And in doing it wholeheartedly, giving himself completely over to that task, something in him started to shine, and he started to smile. And today, the fire hydrant for you has been your breathing. Is it shining yet? Probably not. You haven't done your 40 hours yet. And so, but maybe after 40 hours of polishing that breath, maybe you'll shine. I know that the first day of retreat is often difficult. And if it's not the first day, well, then it'll be the second day. And it's not a mistake that it's difficult. It's just part of the territory, part of what we negotiate, part of what we train ourselves in and practice with. And in fact, if it wasn't difficult, this practice, it probably wouldn't be worth much, because it wouldn't be touching the parts in ourselves that probably are the most in need of being touched, most in need of being seen and related to, and for us to find our way through. So, you know, some of you, it's physical difficulties the first day, the body hurts, headaches. Some of you, it's restlessness and boredom. Some of you, it's tiredness and fatigue. I wouldn't be surprised if thrown in for good measure has been a few bouts of doubt. What am I doing? And what is this? And can I do it? And do these teachers know what they're talking about? And all kinds of doubts. And then there can be all kinds of memories and thoughts and issues that you didn't even know that you carried with you. Sometimes on retreat they pop up, things that have been dormant for a long time and were not recognized as being an issues, and they come and surface. And none of this is a mistake. None of this is meant to be seen as a problem, but rather to be seen as the very material, the fire hydrants in which we work with and we meet. And in meeting what's come for us, what arises for us, it's not what's happening that's so important, but really what's important is how we meet it, how we receive it, how we relate to it. And we're trying to find a way to be with whatever arises where we can find our peace, our ease with that. And if everything that arises we're reacting to and judging and criticizing or wanting or something, then we tend to be entangled, and it's difficult to find the peace, difficult to find the sense of being independent and not caught by our life. So this prisoner, he was caught up in the issues of justice and injustice. Seems like certain way he describes it, it was very unjust what happened to him. And that kind of self-righteousness around justice and the quest for it, which, you know, justice is a very important thing to pursue and support in our world. But it can also trip us up, and we can get attached to it at times when it doesn't serve us at all. And so he felt he was going to protest this injustice, but in the prison system, chances are, in the terrible way these systems work, it would have just been worse for him. And so he found an alternative where he became free of it. I go to San Quentin every year, and it's remarkable to meet these prisoners there. I tend to meet the ones who've taken the turn for the better. Sometimes we hear their stories of how some of them had to be in the prisons for decades before they took the turn for the better. Some of them remember, they've told their stories to us. They were the worst of the worst in prison. At some point, after 15, 20 years, they realized this is not the way forward. And they were ready for a different way. And so the ones I met are the ones who found mindfulness, found this practice we do here. And they were really motivated. And that motivation, they turned themselves around. And they're some of the most shiniest group of people that I've met, the group of people who are part of the Sangha, the practitioners in San Quentin. It's quite something. Last year I was there. I was in a room full of, I think it was about 23 people who had murdered other people. And we all sat together without any guards, just these men. And they had all disavowed what they did. One of them talked about it with tears, about what he had done, and felt very bad about it, and felt that they were supposed to be in prison because of what they had done. But they had turned their life around, and we sat and meditated with them, and the stillness, and not just the stillness, but maybe more important for me, the sincerity, the intention, the commitment to honesty and being present was palpable in the room. And it was very inspiring to be around. I evoked last night the idea of sincerity being an important part of this practice. And rather than looking to how can I get concentrated, or how can I, become more mindful, or how could I, whatever, get rid of or get my crazy mind to stop being so crazy and thinking so much. If the measurement or the approach here was how to meet what's going on with sincerity, how to meet this thing here, right now, with it. What does it mean to be sincere right now? And one of the things that is classically associated with sincerity is honesty and truth. And I think for me, sincerity has a lot to do with the dedication to truth, to being truthful, to what is true right now, and can I meet that, can I see that, can I be with what's true, this love of the truth. And so, in spite of all the difficulties and challenges of the first day, and the mind that wanders off, always the task is, what is true here? How can I meet this? How can I be with this? And in some ways, the training works better when it's more difficult. In the sense that you're building your muscle, you're building your capacity, you're beginning to look at yourself and find out what's challenging for you. I've known people for whom they seem to, for some reason, I don't know why, they have some natural capacity for concentration. And they sit down, and it's very, very inspiring to see some people just sit down and off they sail into some beautiful state of concentration. And for those of us like me, whose concentration doesn't come easy, it was, kind of like envious a little bit, wow, that would be nice. But I've seen oftentimes people who have the most ease at this are the ones who benefit the least from it. And some of them actually seemingly become worse because of it, because they get attached to it, or they start living a divided life where they kind of focus more on this kind of bliss of concentration. They're maybe keeping something at bay and don't want to look at things. I've absolutely the best ability to drop into deep sorts of concentration are people who have lived really divided lives because of trauma. They grew up in very strong situations. The only way they could cope was to somehow separate themselves from the ordinary world and go into these states. But it's not really a healthy kind of division. I think there's something very honest, very mature about not rushing off into wonderful states of practice, but really to sit here and be honest about what is happening here. What is this? Meet what is here and find your way with what's here rather than what is not here. So the classic Buddhist word that's translated as concentration is samadhi. And samadhi is in the Indian context where the word was coined, is a almost like one of the very sacred word, and it evokes a lot of very strong religious connotations of what's most sacred in a number of Indian religions. And in some Indian religions, samadhi is a synonymous of what Buddhists would call nirvana, an enlightenment. Buddhists call it, you know, tend to, in English, call it concentration. It's a step along the way to ultimate freedom. And but it's a very powerful word that I think that the English word concentration doesn't quite do justice to. I know a few people, including myself, that at times the word concentration implies a kind of a narrow laser-like focus, like from the control tower down at something. And in my early years, I thought it was kind of a mental act of kind of looking intently at something and having my inner gaze kind of being unwaveringly. And that works sometimes to give me a headache. So I don't know what is a good translation into English of the word samadhi. Maybe we just translate it, keep it as samadhi. A word that I'm fond of using in English is the word composure. And maybe we can call it sacred composure to give it a kind of little bit more of a pizzazz. And there are a number of reasons I like the word composure. Kind of a small reason is that it just coincidence is that the etymology of the word samadhi, the etymology of the word composure, has the same roots. I mean, not from the same source, but mean the same. So the sam of samadhi means with, and the d part of samadhi means to stand with, to be composed. And composed, of course, means the same. Calm with means with, and pose is like to stand. And so to be composed. And one of the reasons, but the more importantly, I like the word composure because it implies, it's not just a mental act to compose yourself. If you compose yourself to a situation, I think, at least from my associations, it's something you do with your whole being. Like you include your body, you compose yourself. If you ask someone to compose themselves, I think most people would kind of like do something with their body. They would kind of take a deep breath and relax, sit up straight, find a balanced way of being, and kind of be much more embodied and present in a fuller way. And those are my associations with composure, a fullness, a completeness, something that includes my body. It's not just a mental act. And if I can compose my mind, it also has this kind of holistic feeling that I don't get when it just the idea of concentrating. Compose my mind is also to settle it and unify it into kind of a whole that kind of get centered or balanced or settled in some way. And so I wonder what it would be like for you that instead of saying focus on your breathing or concentrate on your breathing or being mindful of your breathing, the instruction was be composed on your breathing. Compose yourself on your breathing. Would that give you a different way of practicing, a different relationship to the practice? Be composed. In Buddhism, the classic, one of the really important terms that or concepts or qualities that's associated with samadhi is the idea of unification. The word is ekodi. And the word has a meaning of weaving together into one. Eko means one, and at this situation, the D comes from the word weave. And to weave together and take all the disparate parts of ourselves that are scattered and fragmented and reactive and, and kind of stop the conflict, stop the struggle between things, stop the division, stop the scatteredness of the mind, and begin to bring everything together in. So it becomes, everything gets composed together or unified, the gathering together of the mind. So it's a very wonderful thing. For some people it's very healing, to get concentrated because of the unifying way in which the places that are fragmented within us or fractured within us start being held together. And the feeling of being whole and complete is very healing experience to be nourished by and supported by. I read recently by a Catholic contemplative, a wonderful man named Father Keating, who was one of the pioneers of contemplative meditation in Christianity in this last generation of teachers. And in describing his way of teaching meditation, he said, it doesn't really matter how long you stay on your object of meditation. It doesn't really matter how often you come back to your object of meditation. What matters is that when you bring your attention to the object of meditation, you do it gently. That's what matters. You bring it gently to it. I used to be in the pouncing school of meditators. I've been in the jerking school of meditators. I've also been in the, I don't know what it's called, but you know, there's this little game where this a gopher comes up and you pound him with a whack-a-mole. I never played it, but I know about it. But I played it in my mind, you know, so like sort of the whack-a-mole kind of approach to meditation. And I've also been in the school of the running away from it. let's focus on the breath. run away in the opposite directions. But I've learned, I never associated the word gentling yourself back on the breath, but I've learned that it's very important, this movement, when you decide to come back and be focused on the breath, for example, how you do that is so important. And just like Father Keating said, maybe it's the most important, the way in which you come back. And can you come back to the breath? Can you focus your attention on the breath in such a way that you enjoy it? Like, this is a nice thing. Like, you want to do this thing. Like, this is, it's a nice thing to bring your attention into the present moment, because you do it in a gentle way, you do it in a loving way, you do it in a kind way, or you do it in a, I don't know, you know, maybe you have your own word for it, but your own idea of what makes it attractive to you and appealing and nurturing for you to kind of wake up and be present for this. You want to be present. Oh, yeah. Not because what you're being present for is nice, but because it's nice to do so, to bring your attention, to be here, be present. So the how. And because then we have a chance to begin being interested in seeing more clearly what's here, because the way our attention is, we want to be here, we want to be attentive. So to bring our attention and focus. For a long time, there was a very strong division in Buddhism between concentration practice and mindfulness practice. And there's a lot of historical reasons for that. Some of them are good reasons. Some of them are unfortunate to make the strong separation. But if you go back to the teachings of the Buddha, it seems that these two qualities or capacities of mind, the capacity to be mindful and capacity to be concentrated, were really wedded together as partners in this endeavor of meditation practice. And you see that in the descriptions of concentration practice and getting into states of concentration, mindfulness is highlighted. There's states of pure mindfulness and states of mindfulness and self-confidence that are present there. And in descriptions of mindfulness practice, the Buddha often refers to these as samadhis, that you're developing samadhi as you do the mindfulness practice itself. So it's nice not to separate them, see them as being one and the same or connected. And so what would it mean to bring those together? One is to focus on not being divided with what you're paying attention to. Remember, you have to be unified, everything together. So this goes back to this idea of how you bring your attention to whatever you're doing. Can you do it? Is there some way of doing it that you're not somehow separate or divided, or it doesn't perpetuate some of the ways in which we are not unified, not whole? And one of the ways that we end up being not whole is by doing the practice selfishly or egotistically, or doing it with too much emphasis on the doer who's going to do it. I'm going to do this, and it's up to me, and I have to be successful, and I have to get something a certain time, and I have to do this and this, this and that and this. This whole idea of being the one who does something, and it's the one who's going to attain something and get something, turns out, it can be reasonable in many cultures, or in some cultures, or some American cultures. It seems reasonable. It often is a way of continuing division with reality, with ourselves, and so this love of the truth that we want to focus on in this practice here, commitment to the truth, is a lot to do with let the truth do the work. Be present for the experience. Let yourself show up. Have a way of turning to the present moment that feels nourishing, feels good for you. And then have a commitment to letting truth show itself to you. What is true now? What's happening now? And so rather than you being the agent, you being the one who's doing, the truth will do you. The Dharma will do you if you get out of the way. So you have to do your part to show up and make the space that can receive your experience. And then what is the truth that wants to show itself to you now? How does truth want to move through you now? And it will. It certainly will. It might be, sometimes it's a little bit unpleasant what it shows at first, because we sit down and get a little bit of quiet, and a lot of the unprocessed stuff that's in there finally has a chance to come out and be processed. Things that are in the subconscious, some things that are covered over by the discursive mind, the discursive thinking and story-making thinking that we kind of, get caught up in. And so deeper issues and feelings and emotions and backlog of things can begin to arise. Or what arises also is our default modes of how we deal with challenges. I don't want to, being on retreats like this is a challenge, especially the first days, and especially for those of you who are new to it. And so we often have default kind of responses to being challenged, to having difficulty, and fight and flight. And so some of you are kind of ready to fight, some of you flight. And my kind of default, when I have no wisdom present and I'm tired and, not my best or something, my approach is the ostrich head approach. I'll just stick my head in the sand and kind of pretend it's not there or something. And so that's another approach. So we have to challenges bring forth these default mechanisms many times we have of, how we respond. And it's not a mistake to have that happen on retreat. It's just more of the truth. It's more of what we have to see for ourselves and turn towards. And again, how we turn towards something and see it is so important. So we turn towards that. Oh, this is, now I'm fighting my experience. Now I'm angry. Now I'm despairing. Now I'm doubting. And then see it as, it's just anger. It's just fighting. It's just, the word just is like magical. Just add just in front of whatever you notice like that. And if you really need heavy medicine, you'd say, it's just anger, of course. What else would you expect? As opposed to believing it or fighting it or adding more and more conclusions about it. So if anger is what's true at the moment, then how do you turn towards it in this way that is gentle, this way that is not fighting or making more division? And then slowly learning how to be with the challenges and difficulties so we're not perpetuating the separation of me, myself, and mine, measuring everything about what's up to me, but being willing to trust, being willing to be devoted to letting truth, letting the Dharma, the reality, work through you. And that's one of the most important things that I've seen, what I feel like I've learned from this practice over these years I've done it, is a very deep trust that if I'm present for the experience without division, without fighting it, without running away, just present in a kind of open, honest way, and I kind of stay with it that way, that the process, everything is a process, and the inner processes know what to do. They know how to unfold. They know how to unwind. They know how to kind of bring to completion or to finish all the different things that are going on inside. And the example I like to give for this is the remarkable capacity of the human body, the physical body, to heal itself from certain injuries, you know, and not all of them, but it's, you know, even to me, I'm amazed when I cut myself, like I'm cut myself, you know, chopping vegetables or something, and it's a phenomenally complex event physiologically for the body to heal that cut. I don't think you have the intelligence, and I'm sure you're all intelligent. I probably don't have the intelligence in your own, with that part of your mind which you consciously can have some say about, where conscious intelligence works. I don't think you probably have enough brain power in that conscious part of your brain to orchestrate the complicated process of healing a cut. But in that little part that's so important, right, little part where we're consciously aware, we have just enough intelligence to know to keep the cut clean. And that's our job, to get out of the way and keep it clean so this inner process of healing can going on. So the same thing is true for our heart, for our psychology, our emotions, and our world and relationship, worlds of relationship with people, is that there's something very powerful that can go on, that if we're mindful and trust it, that things will find their way through us and find their way, and sometimes much more effectively than if we are the one trying to orchestrate our healing or the resolution of what goes on. And from a Buddhist point of view, one of the important aspects of all this ability is not the trusting that things are going to turn out, not the trusting that things will resolve themselves or heal themselves, but it's something actually in some ways much more radical. And that is that we can learn not to be entangled in whatever's going on, not to be glued to it, not to be pushed around by it, that even difficult things and all kinds of very difficult things can arise. And it's kind of like there's lots of space in our mind, in our hearts, to hold it. We're not claustrophobic. We don't get glued to it and attached to it. But it's okay. So there's a headache. It's okay. There's a conflict with someone else. You know, there's space for the conflict, and the mind doesn't have to get contracted around it. And so there's a kind of independence or freedom from what we're experiencing. And whether things can resolve themselves and get healed or not, what we're learning is this kind of way of being independent, being free from the circumstances of what we have. And it's a freedom that I associate with becoming whole, becoming unified, becoming complete, because there's no divisions. We're not fighting parts of ourselves and being one way or the other. So this idea of coming back, how do you wake up? How do you engage your attention to be mindful? And to experiment with that. Try to find, don't assume that the way you do it currently is the only way you have to do it. There might be other ways that are more pleasant, more supportive of you. Try it different ways. Try to kind of use attention very close to the experience and see what that's like. Try to have your awareness be kind of very broad and wide, maybe step back from experience and see it from a distance. Try to be gentle with it. This Father Keating, when he talked about the, you know, a gentle attention, he used the image of placing a feather on a cotton ball. A soft cotton ball, and you place a feather on it gently. So to have that kind of contact between awareness and whatever you're experiencing, what would I like to have that soft touch of the experience, as opposed to my teacher in Burma, his idea of mindfulness, his analogy was eating broccoli. And you have to, and you take your fork, and I guess it's kind of somewhat well-cooked broccoli, and you have to kind of poke the broccoli to pick it up, but you can't push it too hard because it was well-cooked, it would fall apart. But you couldn't poke it too lightly because you couldn't get your fork into it. You had to just penetrate it just the right amount. And it's a good analogy for a way of practicing, for sure. Sometimes it's the right analogy, but sometimes it just, you know, it creates a very different connotation, association, and, you know, pick up your spear and get ready to do, you know, poke everything, and as opposed to a feather, just like your attention is a feather, just place it there, and just let, you know, or maybe kind of let the feather of awareness kind of land softly, peacefully onto what's going on, just be there. All this is pointing to the idea that there can be a certain playfulness in experimentation with how you use your awareness. Don't be so caught up in results, making something go away or attaining something or getting concentrated. But we're beginning to explore the territory of awareness, what it's like to use attention. What is attention? If you kind of begin questioning what is it to be attentive, and what's the experience of attention like, and how can I use my attention, then something different gets born and kind of gets interesting than if you're focusing on results or focusing on an experience you're supposed to get. It's kind of like I've often said this, and you know, if I'm holding something like the striker, and if I'm only interested in the striker, I'm only interested in half the experience. But if I focus on how I'm holding the striker, that's the other half. So I can be blinded by the striker. You know, so I could be grabbing onto it because it's the most beautiful striker in the world and I want to keep it. I could think it's the worst striker in the world and I just really caught up how terrible and embarrassing it is to have such bad striker at IRC, and all of you are going to be judging me terribly because we should have better strikers, you know. So either way, I'm kind of like focusing on the striker. But to turn the attention to focus on how I'm holding the striker is very, very important. And so, you know, you don't have to grip it so your knuckles go white. You can hold it lightly and openly in a different way. So we're often focused on what we're paying attention to, but we're not paying attention much to how we're paying attention. And a lot of the key to our freedom is found in the how we pay attention more than what we're experiencing and what's going on. They're both important. They're both two halves of the picture. But the part that's often neglected is the how we pay attention. So the focus on the talks for this retreat is to explore particular aspects of the attentional world. Attention has there's many things that come together to make up what we call attention. Attention is not a singular thing. It's a composite of many different mental faculties, capacities that work together. I kind of believe the same thing is true of what in English we call awareness. Awareness can sometimes, or consciousness, can sometimes be seen as being a unitary thing. Just, you know, we have a feeling that we're just aware, it's a thing. But I think also awareness also is a composite of many, many different mental functionings that work together harmoniously. And so because they're working harmoniously, they just seem like they're one thing. But have a little bit go wrong in the brain, and you know, things can get a little wacky, and you start realizing it's not so harmonious. So some of the things that, some of the factors that get involved with attention that can be used and brought together for the purposes of practice are some of the factors, some of the many factors involved in getting concentrated. And one of them I mentioned already, which is the unification of mind. We're gathering together so that our different faculties are all kind of gathered together for the same purpose at the same time. Another is that we're using what's called technical language is the initial application of mind, initial application of attention, which is how we, when it's time to bring our attention to something, how we do that. You know, this gentle way that Father Keating talks about. But how we do that movement to pay attention to something, mind wanders off, how do we reestablish our connection? That's called vitakka in Pali, V-I-T-A-K-K-A. And it's a very important quality to learn to use and be curious how it works, not to be the pouncing school, not to be the jerking school, jerk your mind back. Maybe you don't have to even bring your mind back. It's a strange metaphor. I wish we didn't use it, bring my mind back. You just as well say, invite the breath back in. The mind doesn't go anywhere after all. It's just here. And so invite the breath back in rather than, because then you're not jerking the mind around. So that's a very important quality, this kind of initial application putting. And then there's a different muscle that's used in this practice, which is called vichara, which is the muscle that then we hang in there with experience, sustaining the attention over time. And some people are really good at the first one of bringing their attention back, but it never occurred to them to stay then. And so, you know, the mind wanders off. But to come back and then kind of just linger and stay. And many people who get the message that we're trying to have continuity of attention and stay focused for a long time on one thing, sometimes also strain too much in the practice, try too hard. And I think it's much better overall to not be very ambitious. And so yes, we want to sustain the attention, but it's more like it's more like a massage. You come back to the breath, for example, and then you try to stay there for a while, try to stay there longer than the mind would on its own, but just stay there and just hang out there, rest there. And then the mind wanders off, and you come back and try to do it again. The mind wanders off, you could do it again. Each time, maybe you can take a little bit longer. Each time you go off and come back, off and come back, you're kind of like massaging the brain, and something's loosening up and relaxing and letting go. One of the things that's letting go and softening is a strong pull of distraction. Every time we come back, a little bit, maybe incrementally, there was less juice going into those thoughts. And slowly they become quieter and we can stay focused on what's happening now. And this idea of just kind of surfing. When I stay with the breath, it's more like I'm going to surf on the breath for a while. And surfing's fun. So I surf on it, you know, and then most surfers, I think, understand that when I started watching surf, I've never really done much surfing at all, but I'm amazed at how short the surf ride is. They're out there for, you know, hours, and they're pedaling and waiting and waiting and waiting, and finally catch a wave, and, you know, I don't know what a long ride is on a wave, but, you know, some of them don't seem to be on the board for maybe more than 5 seconds. And they seem happy, and then they go out again to do it again. So and our job is to catch the breath. And you ride it as long as you can, and you fall off. and then you get back on your board and do it again. But slowly over time, you can stay longer and longer, and slowly it's like you ease yourself into staying, and not by forcing yourself, but by kind of settling down and relaxing and having the scattered mind quiet down and the forces of distraction quiet down. And it's more of a settling in to the present moment than a holding ourselves to the present moment. And as we settle into the present moment, then we'll stay in the present more and more. And at some point, it can be that the default is to stay present. It becomes easier to stay in the present moment than the work it takes to leave it, to start thinking and going off. And that's a very special point to feel that. For me, the way I experienced it as some point where there's like a, my mind will still want to kind of wander off, but it's like there's an elastic band attached to the thoughts. And so my mind will start going off, but as this elastic band gets stretched, when it gets stretched enough, it pulls it all back in. So I just can't go very far. It's kind of, I find it cool, but it's my idiosyncratic way of practicing with my elastic band. You probably have your own idiosyncratic way of practicing. All the minds are, every mind's unique. And then there's joy. is a factor of concentration. People have different words for this, translations of it. Joy, rapture. sometimes it feels like a thrill, kind of a thrill kind of feeling. And then there's happiness, or some people call it, translate it as pleasure, because it's a particular sublime kind of happiness. It's very physical. And so because it's so physical, some people translate it as pleasure, but I don't. For me, it doesn't capture the richness of it, the warmth, the deep, deep contentment and satisfaction that comes with this. So I prefer translating it as happiness. And then there's self-confidence. Is an important quality that comes as we concentrate, and it's part of the value of concentration, because as we get more focused and centered, that there's a strong sense of power, strength, or confidence in being here. There's mindfulness is an important component part of concentration. It's another of these factors of attention that come into play. And then there's equanimity, an important factor of concentration. And kind of this balanced mind that is imperturbable, you know, doesn't get caught up in the ups and downs of whatever's going on. It just can stay present and stable and balanced. And these are just some of the important factors that come into play in this aspect of our being, which has to do with attention. This amazing capacity we have to pay attention. I was very inspired many years ago when I read. And I forget who it was who said this. we are human beings, our nature is looking at itself. If we don't separate ourselves from nature, we're part of nature. It's an amazing kind of evolution of life and this cosmos of ours, universe of ours, then we're this this blob of particles that came together in a particular way so that nature could see itself. And it's amazing that the sophisticated way in which human consciousness can operate and see and hear and process and experience, the capacity for attention is an amazing thing. And to begin to kind of be in awe or a sense of wonder about how it is to be attentive and be present, and to explore that and to get a sense of it so that it can grow and develop, and so that the capacity for attention, for concentration, for being present in a rich, full way becomes kind of like its own strength that becomes stronger than any, a lot of the other things where the mind might pay attention to. So that you're sitting here and you're on retreat, and there's this confidence in being present, this interest in being present, this wonder about what it's like, wow, to be aware and attentive, and how does this work? Have you ever thought about how you're able to pay attention to anything? Know anything. So you're so in awe of this. And you go down to the dining room for lunch, and they serve your favorite cookie. And you know, the sense of awareness is so strong and so amazing that you don't get yourself contracted around the cookie and focus on it. You're like, wow, it's still wonderful to be attentive and peaceful and present. And then you see that your favorite cookie that they have, there's only one left, and the person in front of you in line took it. Wow, awareness, attention. It just, isn't it amazing I'm aware? Someone took the last cookie and that's what I'm aware of. Isn't it amazing to be aware of that, to know this? That even that I have the capacity to know such things. It's amazing. Again, back to Father Keating. He said, his analogy was that if a person's blind for a long time, decades, and then somehow they're cured of their blindness, and the first thing they see is something that's ugly, that doesn't really matter. They're going to be so amazed and so appreciative that they can see. So they have the capacity to see, to be aware, stand out and highlight and really appreciate it. So we're going to explore this week the factors of these particular factors of our capacity for attention, with the hope that you'll become more interested in your capacity for attention and know how these different qualities of attention can be used to act and be and support you in the practice of mindfulness and attention, and from a Buddhist point of view, to help you in the process of becoming free, becoming awake and becoming liberated, becoming independent in the Dharma. So I'll end with reading this letter that I read today that was sent here to Insight Retreat Center from a prisoner of San Quentin. So, dear Gil, I sincerely hope in the best way for everyone. That's what it says, I think. I sincerely hope in the best way for everyone. May your hearts be. May your heart be. I take that to be a good sentiment. Here, inside of the San Quentin Sangha, we are alert to the inner well-being, which is ever-present at all times. Thanks to our cherished volunteers from the surrounding Bay Area, we are vibrant in the practice for mindfulness meditation. I sit as often as allowed, Sunday, Monday, and Friday, in the three available groups, the Buddha Dharma group, the centering prayer group, and the mindfulness group. The recent retreat held at your center was brought to my attention by the person who was the manager for that retreat, who had went into San Quentin to support the Buddhist group there. And I am impressed by the sincere work being done on behalf of all beautiful souls. Isn't that nice? Referring to all of you. People who do retreats here. It is my desire to learn and to grow with the practice. Zen have cleared the way of experience. Unlike other means along the path to understanding, the unique opportunity presented through stillness and silence have given my soul clarity. Isn't that nice? So this practice given his soul clarity. I was born in 1955, and I came into the prison system in 1983. I have not been on the other side of the walls since. And then he's thinking he might get released this spring. My experience in the practice will continue on the other side. Best wishes. That was kind of nice. So this person who found so much value in the practice and peace and stillness and then I think because of the value that he found in the practice in his community in San Quentin prison, when he learned about IRC, something in him resonated, something in him spoke to him, or he recognized something it inspired him. So you don't know what your practice here will do. Maybe the biggest impact of your practice here is that some prison will hear about what we're doing and be changed, knowing that what people do here. Maybe it'll be a relative or a friend or someone else back in Paris that will learn about this and discover what a wise thing it was to come here after Paris, because someone has to do this inner work. And you're not abandoning the people in Paris. I think this is, you're doing the deep, deep work of really being able to touch the center of the heart's deepest places, and healing and possibility. And someone needs to do this work. Otherwise, there's no hope for our society, I think. So it's a beautiful thing that you're doing, really wonderful. And I'm very appreciative of all of you coming here and being here and engaged in each in your own way. And I hope that your way is, you recognize it's being sincere in your terms, what being sincere effort means for you. And as I said earlier, I know the first day is difficult, and I know that giving a long talk the first day can be deadly, because people are tired, and you know, the teacher goes on and on, but I do appreciate you all very much, and I look forward to this week together. Thank you. And it's a custom here that we would, at the end of a talk, to take a minute or two, just sit back in silence, go back into meditation, just to make a nice transition back into the contemplative mode as we continue the retreat.